My guest this morning is Farah Mokhtarizadeh, and she hosts the website Steal This Hijab. Thank you for joining us, Farah.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, could you explain to the listeners what a hijab is?
Sure. Hijab is a cloth that women wear on to cover their hair. Also, we call it a veil in English. Hijab is just the word for veil in Arabic. And there's many different kinds of hijabs, but yeah, it's just the cloth that women wear over their hair to symbolize their religious adherence in Islam.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So why the name, or where did the title for the website originate, Steal This Hijab?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a play on a book that was published in 1971 by the anti-war activist Abby Hoffman. Mm-hmm. His book was called Steal This Book. And Steal This Book advocated tangible ways of living outside of the capitalist system and did it in a way that he sort of wanted people to critically think about their relationships to the earth and to other people. And so his tangible ways weren't just tangible ways of living outside the capitalist system. It was a way of increasing people's awareness of community and that inspiring them to action. And so Steal This Hijab is a similar kind of idea, sort of a thought experiment of mine where I wanted to share my work with other people and hopefully get a dialogue going about gender and Islam.
In that similar way, you're asking people to think critically and take back their freedom in terms of gender for people in the Muslim world.
Yeah, I mean, it's really for it's for all kinds of people. I think that it's, you know, it comes out of my research of women's rights groups in the Muslim world and in the Middle East mainly. But also it comes out of a lot of conversations I've had with people in Europe and America who have this idea that the word Islam and feminism are somehow oxymoronic, that they don't go together. And from my experience and from my research and from my sort of activism life, feminism in Islam goes back just as far as feminism does in North America. And so I wanted people to know that and to know about the different movements. And it seems to me that, you know, when I talk to people about it, they're surprised, when I talk to people here in America about it, they're surprised to hear that there's these movements happening. And so it makes them rethink a lot of their assumptions about Islam and about war, etc. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of engaging with a broader audience, other than just my friends or mm-hmm. you know people that I know.
So what is the format of the website for the listeners who aren't familiar with it? Is this like a blog, or there's articles here, or
Yeah, I mean, it's stealthishijab.com, and it's mainly a blog. I did it on WordPress, you know, it's still new. It's only about 2 months old that I started it, but it's a blog with different topics that you can, you know, click on that include, there's a whole section on why I chose to call it Steal This Hijab and some of my ideas behind why I wanted to do it and also what I hope it will do in the future. And then there's a part about Islamic feminism, and I just choose some articles that I thought are really foundational to understanding what Islamic feminism is. And then I, you know, coming out of this past year where the Arab Spring has been happening, I've been trying to keep on top of how women have been participating in the Arab Spring and showing videos and art and articles that women are writing about their participation in changing their societies. Mm-hmm. And then I also have sections on women's engagement with peacemaking and ending war, and especially for me, this past year I've been doing a lot of research on Afghanistan, and so there's a section of the website that are interviews with people that I met in Afghanistan this past December, talking about how the war affects their lives, and talking with some people who wanted to come up with an alternative to the military strategy in Afghanistan that would be a peaceful alternative. And so there's videos and a few letters from different people that I met speaking to that.
Mm-hmm. And are you able to tell from the website where the where your visitors are visiting from? What different countries and things?
What countries? There probably is. I am really curious about that myself, but I haven't been able to tell that yet. I do get my site stats, and I see how many people visit the website and what sort of searches people do. For example, a lot of people search just hijab or hijab and art or Islamic art and come across my website, or the Arab Spring and come across my website. But I haven't been able to tell yet exactly where they're coming from. Although, I'm guessing that a lot of my advertising for my website comes through Facebook. I put up, a Facebook status message with a link to an article that I've published on my website. And so I imagine that a majority of people probably either come from the U.S. and Ireland, which are a majority of my friends, but also Iran, I think, is the next biggest place that people click on it, and that's also because I'm Iranian and have lots of friends from there. So,
and what does the term Arab Spring mean?
There's been a lot of writing about that. There's a quote from this. From Iranian poetry that has been attributed to lots of different people, most recently to the activist Mollalai Joya from Afghanistan, that says, where she says, "You can cut the flower, but you can't stop the coming of spring." Mm-hmm. And I think I think what is meant by that is that people will in the Arab world are wishing to do some self-organizing and to have more control over their own lives. Mm-hmm. And so I think the Arab Spring is where people are finally saying that they're not going to be told what to do anymore. They're not going to be silent in the face of great injustices, and so they're organizing to take back their own lives and to take back their countries, and do it in a way where there's very little do it in nonviolent ways and in ways that respects all different kinds of people and where they're coming from. I think that the Arab Spring is it's about democracy, but a democracy that's real, not a democracy that that we have here, where depending on your economic status, you have more access to democracy. I think it's over there. It's people from all different walks of life that are joining together to participate in creating institutions that that serve all people. I don't know. That's what I think it is.
I met a radio host who is Iranian, and he has a program, and I was speaking with him, and he told me that the Iranian people are very poetic. There's a lot of poetry in the culture, and that mm-hmm. was something that was surprising to me. I don't know why, but I never occurred to me, I guess because I don't know anything about Iran, and so I was ignorant of the fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, poetry is a big part of the culture, and for lots of different reasons. I mean, I know people who daily will open a book from Hafez or Rumi or Shamli or any of the Iranian or Farooq Sarafjad, Iranian Islamic feminist poet, for daily inspiration. Like, some people open up religious books for inspiration. But also, I think poetry really serves a tangible place in people's lives in terms of political analysis. And it's sort of, especially under situations where, you know, you're not allowed to speak freely about your political views, people utilize poetry in order to do that. And sometimes it's more obvious than other times. But there are also, I mean, poetry is a very old medium in Iran and also in Arab countries. I think that people are using video and film to do that same thing in a modern way today. Yeah. So.
What have you discovered in your studies about feminism in the Muslim world that relates to gender and transgender and different forms of sexuality in the Muslim world?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that kind of a hard question. I think that, you know, gender and sexuality in the Muslim world and the way it's talked about is a little different than the sort of progressive sort of culture that we have here, where people are, you know, allowed to be out, you know, where people can appear. You know, there's queer communities that are accepted. Of course, it depends on where you live, but mainly, I think that there's, you know, that in North America anyway, that there's a different way of people being able to identify and be out and open about that doesn't happen as much in Muslim world. But I still think that people would be surprised, people here would be surprised about the different cultural experiments and ways people are identifying in the Muslim world. For example, one big example I always talk about is that in Iran, it's currently illegal to be gay, and that especially male gay sex is completely forbidden, and if you're caught, then, you know, you could face the death penalty. But also in Iran, being transgender and wanting to change yourself physically is accepted by the state and even subsidized. So Iran has become the sort of transgender capital of the Middle East, where people who want to actually change themselves physically can go to Iran and have an operation, and it would be subsidized by the Iranian state. And that really came out of a story of a young person who, during the Iranian Revolution in 1979, wrote a letter to Khomeini talking about, at the time, his feeling that he was, you know, female and a female gender, and eventually found out where Khomeini was. Some point during the revolution, Khomeini was sitting in a mosque and talking to folks about, you know, about the revolution or what they were going to do. And this man, at the time, entered the mosque and started taking off all of his clothes and crying and you know, sort of beseeching Khomeini and saying that he, you know, he wanted to change his gender. And so and Khomeini took some, you know, he took sort of pity, I guess, on this person. And from then on, you know, or he wrote a fatwa, and from then on, it was legal for people to change their gender. And he, and interestingly, used Islamic arguments to talk about that rather than civil arguments. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so, you know, that's just one example. But again, for some people that might think a little bit deeper, I mean, that's, I think for the Iranian state, that's a way of controlling this idea that gender is very binary, that you're either male or female.
Right.
And I think that, you know, affirming people of queer identities or queer sexualities, that line is very much blurred. So, you know, there's still a huge sort of problem in the analysis there, and a lot of ways to move forward. But yeah, I mean, I still think people would be surprised here to hear that you're you know, welcome to have a sex change operation in Iran, you know, for example.
Now, do you have offers from other writers to submit pieces to your website to be included in the conversation?
I have friends a lot, because I'm an activist and work in sort of anti-war organizing and with some campaigns in the Middle East for gender justice. I do have some friends who are working along with me who are also activists and writers or academics that are, you know, suggesting pieces for me to publish. But it's still new, and I'm still taking suggestions, and I'm still trying to find more people to publish things more frequently to the website. So hopefully that can happen soon. But it's really new, so it hasn't happened in any intentional way yet.
Right. Is it also mm-hmm. your intention to be posting other articles that you find of interest, or it's just generally with yourself and people you know or people that you contact?
I think when I first started it, you know, it was a way for me to engage a larger community with some of the sort of broader social networks of exchange about Islam and gender, and so I think, you know, because I, being a PhD student, sort of sit in a library all day and read all this stuff and don't get to talk to people, and for me it's really important that people, for my learning process, that I am able to engage with other people, and so I, you know, I think that's probably true, not just if you're a PhD student, but even, you know, if you're an activist and you read a book and you get really inspired and you want to be able to talk to other people, you know, for various reasons, maybe you can't. So I think for me, this starting this website was a way to start a conversation with other people. And, you know, because it's new, I haven't had lots of exchanges yet, but every time that I talk about Field of Hijab and I talk about some of the ideas behind it, I get a lot of interest from people. And so I think eventually, you know, it would be able to be used as a, not only just an exchange, but also as a sort of teaching tool that other people who want to do education on Islam and gender can use. So eventually I hope there's a community of people that are participating in the dialogue and using the website to do education and to organize.
And so if someone who's in Iran does a search on the internet, would they be able to find your website, presumably?
yeah, absolutely. A big sort of goal of mine is to have all of the content on my website translated into Farsi and into Arabic. And there are a few articles in Arabic, and in Farsi, but definitely the majority is in English. So certainly a person, I believe, there are firewalls. I believe that they can find it from Iran, but it needs to be accessible in terms of language, and it's not there yet, but hopefully.
I see on the website there is the hijab is a symbol in Islam, and what could you say about the symbol that it is?
I took a course, a graduate course on Islam and religious imagery, and I think that the professor was trying to make a point in the course that that Islam is a religion that is steeped in art, and I think there's an impression that Islam is an iconoclast religion, that there's maybe that there's not art in Islam or something, and so he was trying to reverse that idea, and so I wrote that paper out of that course that I took because I wanted to talk about the hijab in terms of what it did symbolize. I think that people make a lot of assumptions about what it symbolizes, and not that those assumptions are incorrect, but I think people would be surprised that, for example, women wear the hijab as a symbol of their feminism, as a symbol of their feminist beliefs, and as well as wearing the hijab for reasons of religious piety. What I found in the end is that the power of the hijab symbolically is that it can mean many different things. And so, you know, it really takes on whatever sort of power or whatever sort of idea the individual, you know, has of it. And also to say, you know, in some places where it's very common to wear hijab, you know, there's almost no thought that goes into wearing it. Just, you know, it's just a very normal thing that people have done for a long period of time, and so there's not like this idea that either it's oppressive or it's an expression of their progressive political beliefs. It's just sort of another article of clothing, and so that's what I mean. Its symbolism is really open to interpretation.
Let me just take a moment to remind the listeners, you're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. And Farah, if you would tell us the name of your website again.
Yeah, it's feelthishijab.com.
And hijab is spelled?
It's spelled H-I-J-A-B.
Thank you. And if anyone has any questions, comments, you'd like to reach us here in the station, the telephone number is 315-859-4200. 315-859-4200. What about the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers? This is also is that just a side note to all this?
Absolutely not. You know, I'm studying Islam and gender, and it's, you know, I'm doing sort of a long-term academic research, but my academic life really comes out of my activist life, and so for the past 10 years since, you know, I graduated from high school, I've been working with peace groups in the United States and in the Middle East to talk about the effect of U.S. foreign policy on communities that we've waged war on, especially the war, you know, how the war on terror affects people on the ground. And so the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers are a group of young boys from Bamiyan in Afghanistan that the group that I've worked with, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, here in the States, got in touch with when the boys had joined a conference call that our members were a part of during the Witness Against Torture, the people who want to close Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. They had gotten together in January, and they had this conference call with these folks from Bamiyan who were the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, who were trying to promote peaceful alternatives to the military strategy in Afghanistan, and they were doing it from within their country. And we became very inspired talking to them because these boys had read some of the writings of our own well-known peace activists like Martin Luther King and Howard Zinn, Emma Goldman, and could quote, you know, quotes from Martin Luther King's Beyond Vietnam speech back to us, you know, and it was just very, for us, very surprising and inspiring. And so the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers has been a group that that my group has partnered with to try and raise awareness amongst people in the U.S. and Europe, really anybody who comes from a country that NATO is a part of, to talk about how the war is affecting people on the ground in Afghanistan and sort of to deconstruct the strategy that the Obama administration has put forward that they claim is working in Afghanistan that I think, you know, fortunately, unfortunately, 10 years later, people are really beginning, really only beginning to question. So, you know, my website is supposed to raise lots of different questions, raise lots of different ideas, and for me, because of the war on terror, and because of the way that war uniquely affects women, it's very important for me to also address questions of war. And so the stuff that I have on there from the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers and from my trip to Afghanistan, I think is part and parcel of what I want to do with the site. And that's why it's included. But you'll also find that it's Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, but I also have an interview with a woman called Mola Wajdoya that many people in the States now, because she's an outspoken advocate for an end to the war in Afghanistan. And then I also have some interviews that I was able to do in what they call an IDP camp, internally displaced persons camp in Afghanistan, which are people that I assume were probably either formerly Taliban or formerly part of some kind of militia in Afghanistan, who've been displaced from their homes in the war and who have gone to Kabul because they had no place else to go. And I think a lot of people don't know, but just within the last year and a half, close to 125,000 people have been displaced from their homes in the south of Afghanistan and have traveled to Kabul to live in these camps that are, you know, not human places to live. And that in fact, the city of Kabul in the last 5 years has gone from 850,000 people to close to 5 million people. And a majority of people coming there because they've, you know, for one reason or another been displaced from their homes or lost their businesses or any myriad of things because of the war. And so these interviews that I have on there with these people would be what I would like to say are, you know, possibly people who are part of the Taliban, but you can, I think it, you know, sort of pricks people's consciousness to think, you know, harder about who are the Taliban and why people join the Taliban and is it, you know, all out of ideological sort of adherence to Islam or something, or is it because, you know, or is it because people out of economic necessity join the Taliban because they feel they don't have any other choices? And again, those are sort of questions that I want to raise with people in the U.S. who I think are in a unique position to end the war on terror.
Well, it's interesting. I'm thinking about the connection between some people now are claiming out of economic necessity it's necessary for them to risk poisoning everyone else's water with hydrofracking because they're so poor. They feel that there's no other options for them to make money. I mean, it's not a direct connection, but it's something that crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm.
how does war uniquely affect women?
Well, in many different ways. I think that, you know, as a lot of us know, that in modern history, the people who die most in war are the most vulnerable people, mostly civilians, and for women, I think that, and I've seen that, that definitely be the case, that there's very high statistics of children and women killed in war, but also because in societies where men are the main sort of workers who earn a wage, when a man is killed in war, a woman can be left to try to take care of not only herself but possibly many children.
Mm-hmm.
In a society that doesn't allow women's work to you know that women's work is not compensated with a wage. And so I think that drives women into poverty, particularly. But I think war affects people in general. There's a lot of literature on how war affects women in particular, but I think it possibly economically is one that they're killed in high numbers during war. That also, unfortunately, there's strategies, real horrible strategies of using gender-based violence, rape, as a weapon of war.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in those ways, I think women are, you know, are affected very deeply by
mm-hmm.
by war.
Mm-hmm. And you have been a witness to on the ground of the war that's happening currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a way, I mean, I did travel to Afghanistan in December, and I have in my activist sort of life traveled many times. I lived in Iraq and you know, was in Palestine and Lebanon, and all during times of war. And for me, you know, it's really convinced me that we really need to work on strategies to ending war and strategies of resistance. That those questions of how to strategize, how to organize and to end war are so important, and to move beyond just complaining about our leaders or complaining about how our communities don't look the way that we want them to. We really need to get ourselves together and organize to end wars. And I think especially, you know, it's what is it, just the end of July here, and in September and October, October especially, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, the longest running war in U.S. history. We're also coming up on the 10th anniversary of September 11th, which obviously has affected so many people here in America, especially in New York. And I just think that 10 years later, you know, what have we learned from these horrible acts of violence? It seems that the sort of majority in Congress of our representatives continue to think that using more violence, you know, throwing money into war is the answer. And I think we're seeing so clearly that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so for me, I really want people to not only just engage in conversations about the war, but also to really demand from their representatives and you know, an end to the war, and where they can't get anywhere with their representatives, to do self-organizing in their community, to educate other people and to work together to raise questions about the war and hopefully to end it. I'm working currently on a curriculum with the War Resisters League that we're hoping to send out to lots of peace groups around the country that they can use to talk about the war economy. And also there's going to be a part of it that talks about the different groups in Afghanistan who are working to come up with nonviolent alternatives, who are working to protect women's rights or who are working to protect the environment despite the fact that they're living in a war zone. Very courageous people who are coming together to organize that we think can inspire people here also to do the same.
Mm-hmm. In the Islamic religion, is there any place for women within the religion? I don't, I'm not very familiar with how it works.
Sure, yeah. I think that, there's definitely a place. I mean, within a sort of religious, I hate to use the word, but religious hierarchy. Religion is very good at creating hierarchies. But there are definitely women who are imams, which are, you know, pastors, if you will, or priests in the Islamic faith. There are women who do what is called ijtihad. It's basically interpretation of the sacred text of the religion. Women do that. Mm-hmm. It's in far fewer numbers than men, and it's you know, something that's fairly newer in the sense that women are taking actual positions, especially like in Iran. Since the 1979 revolution, the Iranian state has been invested in training women to do interpretation of the Islamic scriptures. And then in different places like Egypt and Morocco, there's a tradition of women, you know, going to basically what we would call seminaries and coming out and having positions of religious quote unquote authority in the religion. And there's lots of literature on that and lots of, you know, searches that you can do to find out information about that. And that's just in the Islamic world. Also here, in North America, there's been a lot of women who are leaders in mosques and in religious communities. One well-known woman is named Amina Wadud, and she's written a lot of books about the place of women in the Quran, women being religious leaders, and the need for Islam to really embrace women as people who can have some kind of religious authority, it's at least 30 to 40 years old that women have been in these positions of religious authority in Islam.
Relating to Christianity, I hear that there's different people argue over different books being part of the original religion, and why were certain books selected to be mm-hmm. part of the Bible and some were omitted. Is there anything like that in Islam where there's earlier texts of the Quran that were not included, or at certain points things were excluded? And I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that also I heard that in earlier Christianity that women did have roles and then they got written out as time went on.
Yeah, absolutely. That happens in Islam, and some of the roots behind splits in different sects of the Islamic tradition. I think lots of people know about lots of people know that there's two sort of main sects in Islam, Sunni and Shiaism, and sort of what there's lots of reasons why that happened, but one of them is because Shias will accept some writings, what they call hadith, which is the sayings and life of the Prophet Muhammad. There's a whole science behind what's acceptable in the Islamic scriptures in terms of these sayings and and sort of remembrances of his life. And for Sunnis, there's a particular line, a very, very strict science behind it, and they, you know, have accepted one tradition, and it's not really open to some writings that Shias claim are part of that, that should be part of that tradition, or should be included. And so, I mean, yeah, so there's that. But there's also, like, you know, it also begs the question, ideas on, like, exactly what you were bringing up. I mean, who, asking ourselves historically, who decided what should be included and what should be not, and sort of how, you know, how that person's socialization at the time, you know, what they, you know, why they made those decisions. So, like, for example, just a really easy example is to say, like, well, if a man said, this is what the Prophet Muhammad said, you know, or a woman said this, it could be that at the time, because people lived in a patriarchal society, that obviously, like, the man, what the man said would have more authority to the person deciding than the woman. And that is, you know, our religious traditions. It's a very sort of simplified, reduced way of putting it, but it's definitely, I think, had a large implication on what we believe is sacred or not sacred text. And obviously, religious traditions, including Islam, have spent thousands of years arguing over these basic questions. And I think for women, it's been very important, and in Islamic feminism especially, I think it's been important that there are some women who take seriously the Islamic intellectual tradition and want to study the Quran and study the Hadith and make arguments for the inclusion of women that are rooted in traditional sort of ways of arguing, traditional texts. And then there are some women who believe that there's no way of sort of redeeming that tradition, and wish to say that, you know, that the Islamic intellectual tradition is rife with patriarchy, and that they want something new, and so come at Islamic feminism through a lens of you know, that's not exactly traditional. And I think that for myself, I think we need both people who want to work within the institution to sort of reform the institution, and people who feel that they can't and want to work outside of it. I think that those two traditions of people should really sort of be speaking to one another and utilizing the strengths of each of those approaches to come up with, you know, some sort of egalitarian progressive space. But that's definitely, you know, an issue in the religious traditions and in Islam.
Are there any other religious traditions in those areas that are not Islam, or smaller, more tribal religions that existed there?
You mean like in the Islamic world?
I guess I'm or just thinking of in the Iranian, Afghanistan, and Iraqi areas. I don't know what you'd call the land mass there, the Middle East.
Sure, you know, almost definitely. There's lots of different. Different traditions, and, you know, in the Islamic world, and there's a history of Muslims and people in other religions getting along, as well as the history of them not getting along. Both are very rich. I mean, in Iran, for example, Zoroastrianism, which some people claim it was the first monotheistic religion, and other people, you know, doubt that, but is Zoroastrianism is still, at least culturally speaking, a big part of Iran and Iranian people's lives. For example, Iranian New Year. It's called Nowruz, and it's a celebration that comes out of Zoroastrianism, not of out of Islam. Mm-hmm. And it's widely accepted, and you know, even the most hardline mullahs in Iran or Ahmadinejad will celebrate Nowruz, even though it's not an Islamic holiday. And I think that there are other examples of that in the Middle East. And certainly we know that there's many examples of other religions, Christianity, Copts, Judaism, all of that, you know, in the Middle East. I was reading an article about sort of the outcome of what's happening in Egypt and in the Middle East more generally, in the last 10 years, having to do with minority religions and people from different religious sects, living together, and notice that since the war on terror began, there's been an issue where, for example, in Iraq, people who came from different religious backgrounds, maybe Sunni or Shia backgrounds or Muslim or Christian backgrounds, used to live together, you know, in the same neighborhood, and, you know, fine. And since the war on terror, there's been a shift, I think, in the Middle East in terms of acceptance of different religious sects. And now there's been a lot of sectarian violence having to do with religious identity. That's very sad, you know, that really hadn't been as much of a problem previous to the war on terror. But anyway, yeah, there's lots of different religious identities or non-religious identities in the Middle East.
In your studies on Islamic feminism, what is the most surprising or exciting information that you've come across, or something that you were very passionate about specifically?
I think that I'm always really inspired by people who dare to organize when they're under the sort of threat that they're under. I find that very inspiring. And that's not anything in particular, you know, to Islamic feminism or to the Middle East in general, but I think it's, for me, it's a driving force behind why I study, for example, being in Afghanistan, where in the last even 30 years, women have been, there's been systematic oppression against women and disembodiment of women in public space, and I met so many women who are very patiently working to try to change their society, to try to reverse some of what happened under the Taliban, and I just think that for me it's surprising and exciting for the reason that one, you know, if you're having to work in a space where someone is not acknowledging your humanity, it can be very difficult. But also to think about how to organize with others to resist sexism and patriarchy on a larger scale, and you know, just comprehending how long that's going to take and how sort of little might change possibly in your lifetime, and yet doing it anyway, or doing it, women, some of my close friends are women who are part of the 1 million signatures campaign in Iran, who, a campaign that is trying, you know, their basic goal is to end discriminatory laws against women in Iran, and they have been infiltrated by the police. Many of them have been put in jail. One of my good friends is a journalist. Her name is Maryam Hosseini Khar. She works for Radio Zamané, which people can listen to on the internet. And she was, for her organizing, for trying to, particularly around trying to change the marriage age in Iran from 9 years of age to 13 years of age, collecting signatures for that. She was put into Evin prison, put on death row for 45 days. And while she was in prison, she started organizing the other women prisoners, even though she was facing a death sentence. And I'm inspired by that, and I think that's happening all over. I just got a letter in the mail the other day from a friend of mine whose name is Salim. He's a Puerto Rican man who is in prison in Pittsburgh. He's Muslim, and he came to Islam while he was in prison. He's serving a life sentence, and he's very interested in the Arab Spring. And because, you know, people in prisons don't have access to the internet, he, you know, writes to people and has them send him information. And it's amazing the knowledge that he has of what's going on, considering. And he wrote an article that is up on my website recently about women's participation in the Arab Spring that really was humbling to me, because despite the fact that he's in prison for life, that he went to prison at 15 years of age, he's still wanting to help raise awareness and consciousness about women's rights issues for women in the Middle East. You know, I find that to be very inspiring. You know, so people who work despite their conditions or despite, you know, their lives being threatened is an inspiration to me. But I also want to say, Pete, though, that it doesn't have to be that extreme. I think there are small ways that people participate and organize, small ways that people engage in politics, or ways that are never sort of regarded or looked upon, not even in extreme circumstances. But I have a professor at Penn who I took a course from 10 years ago, who is so interested in teaching and raising a critical consciousness in his students, and I find him to be very inspiring because he takes his job seriously and wishes to inspire students to be engaged in their world, and that inspires me as well. And I still think about his class 10 years later. So any number of things. I don't know if that's really an answer to your question, but it's not surprising, but it's definitely inspiring.
Mm-hmm. That definitely answers the question. Is there maybe a few books you could recommend to listeners, and then maybe a few websites?
Well, sure. I've included, if people visit fieldofhijab.com, I have included a bibliography for people to take a look at, because I got that question a lot. One of the sort of foundational texts that people read that I think is very, very good and raises lots of interesting questions is by a woman called Fatima Mernissi, and her book is called The Veil and the Male Elite, A Feminist Interpretation of Women's Rights in Islam. And it was published in 1992, and I think originally her work was, started from the 70s. But I think she does a very good job of giving you an introduction to Islam and gender and the different issues there. But I would check out that my bibliography page. There's one other thing that people can search for one other article that people can search for that's been a foundational, and it's by this woman called Chandra Mohanty Talapade, and it's called Under Western Eyes, Feminist Scholarship and Colonial Discourses. And it talks about transnational feminism and sort of a very contemporary ideas of feminism that takes account of the differences between women in different places and in different contexts. So you know, the ways that we talk about being a feminist in America might be very different than the ways that women talk about being a feminist in you know, Iran. And just to realize that those differences are a place for us to work from, to, you know, sort of to contour each other's work rather than being rather than just whitewashing it or you know, utilizing difference to put down another person's expression. So I think it's, you know, those kinds of discussions about talking about difference as a place to work together is very interesting. And then there's lots of websites. I would just encourage really people to put Islamic feminism into a Google search. There is another website that I get a lot of articles off of that publishes way more than I could ever hope to, and it's called Jadalia. And Jadalia will have some really excellent articles about the Arab Spring and a whole myriad of issues related to politics in the Middle East and in the Islamic world that people should check out.
Great, and let me just tell the listeners one more time that your website, Steal This Hijab, is stealthishijab.com.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much, Farah, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Pete.
And have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, you too.
Bye.
Bye.